I should point out that this sermon is not entirely voluntary because Kathy Harn bought it at Ranchers Service Auction and saddled me with an Easter sermon on a particular day. But anyway. So let's begin. In those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be enrolled. This was the first enrollment, when Quirinius was governor of Syria. All went to be enrolled, each to his own city, and Joseph also went up to Galilee. Well, after all, this is April Fool's. Now, let's go on to the resurrection, which is no joke, it never is. In his article, he opened the resurrection in the March 2016 New Year World, Reverend Scotty McLennan began, and I have a problem with people reading me long quotations where I can't follow, so I'm going to try to put the longer quotations up here on the screen. And if you're way back and can't read them, I urge you to move forward. He said, few Unitarian Universalists believe that there was a physical, photographical resuscitation of Jesus' corpse. Few believe that Jesus knowingly sacrificed his life to atone for the sins of humanity, or that only by his sacrifice and our belief in him as our Lord and Savior can each of us individually be saved. There is also very little biblical evidence for those claims. Because the disciples came to believe that Jesus was alive again with them, a religious movement was launched. Indeed, the word apostle came to mean appointed witness of the resurrection. Now, perhaps part of our problem with resurrection is that each account of it is different. Mark's version is probably the earliest. A woman named Salome goes with Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of the Apostle James, to anoint the corpse, but they see the stone has already been rolled back from the tomb. A young man in white says Jesus is risen. He says the women should tell the apostles and that Jesus was going to Galilee, as he said he would. Quote from the Gospel of Mark, and they went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had come upon them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. There is no explanation how anyone found out, since, quote, they said nothing to anyone. There is no explanation, and that's the end of it. Nothing about what happened in Galilee. In one version of Mark, however, not included in the standard Protestant Bible, there is a last verse that says, Jesus, quote, taken up into heaven and sat down at the right hand of God. But that's not an unusual version. The somewhat later Gospel of Mark has more detail, some of it conflicting. When the two Marys, no mention of Salome or anybody else, go to the tomb, there's a great earthquake, not mentioned in any of the other Gospels. An angel rolls back the stone and sits on it. He's brighter than the young man in Mark, quote, his appearance was like lightning, and his raiment white as snow. So I guess the farther away you get from the event, the brighter the angel gets. The angel tells the two women not to fear because he knows they see Jesus. He invites them to see the empty tomb. He tells them to tell the disciples that Jesus has risen from the dead and is going to Galilee, where they will see him. So they departed quickly from the tomb with fear and great joy and ran to tell his disciples. And behold, it says, Jesus met them and said, hey. And they came and took hold of his feet and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, do not be afraid. Go and tell my brethren to go to Galilee, and there they will see me. This gospel ends with Jesus telling the apostles to, quote, make disciples of all nations. It says nothing about why Jesus didn't appear to the disciples in Jerusalem, where he appeared to the women, but instead appeared in Galilee, nor where Jesus went from Galilee. Luke's still later version is again different. Not just the two Marys, but also a woman named Joanna and other, quote, women who had followed him from Galilee, unquote, go to the tomb to anoint the corpse. Then two men, not just one, in dazzling apparel, appear and ask them why they seek the living among the dead. The women remember that Jesus had said he would rise on the third day, and they go and tell the remaining 11 disciples, remember that Judas had committed treason by them, but the disciples do not believe the women. The same day, Jesus appears to two disciples in Emmaus, only about 7 miles away from Jerusalem, not in Galilee. But these two don't recognize him. Then at supper, they finally recognize him, and he vanishes. The two of them return to Jerusalem. There they find, quote, the 11 gathered together. I don't see how this works because they are two out of the 11. How can they find themselves gathered together? Anyway, Jesus appears to the 11. They're frightened and they think they see a ghost. To prove he isn't, he eats a piece of boiled fish. Then he leads them out as far as Bethany, blesses them, and leaves. Nothing about Galilee, nothing about where Jesus goes from Bethany, except some old non-standard versions and is carried up into heaven. John, which is the only non-synoptic gospel, says much more. That's odd. His gospel was written after the other three, so one would expect it to have less detail, not more. Again, it's different, too. Only Mary Magdalene comes to the tomb, sees the stone's been taken away, and runs to Simon Peter and one other disciple. They all run to the tomb and find no body, and the disciples go home. Only then does Mary look into the tomb and see two angels in white. They ask her why she is crying. She replies, "Because they have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." Then she turns around and sees Jesus, but doesn't recognize him. He asks why she's weeping. She supposes he's the gardener and says, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him and I will take him away." Then she recognizes him. He says, "Do not hold me, for I have not yet ascended to the Father. But go to my brethren and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." Mary then goes to the disciples and tells them what happened. In the evening, Jesus appears to the disciples except to Thomas. They tell Thomas. He says he won't believe it until he can put his finger in the mark of the nails in Jesus' hands and put his hand in Jesus' side. 8 days later, Jesus reappears and lets Thomas do this. Then Thomas no longer doubts. Sometime later, Jesus reveals himself to the disciples a third time by the Sea of Galilee, but again, they don't recognize him for a while. Nothing here about where Jesus goes then, and the only thing about an ascension is what he told Mary at the tomb. Now, what if the Gospel of, let's say, Matthew would end this way? Now, after the Sabbath, toward the dawn of the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the tomb. They implored the guards to roll back the stone that sealed the tomb. The guards consented and rolled it back. In the tomb lay the body of Jesus, wrapped in a clean linen shroud, just as Joseph of Arimathea had left it. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary recited a prayer for the dead and went home. Dismayed that their leader had been crucified, Jesus' disciples left Jerusalem and went their separate ways, most taking care that no one knew they had been followers of Jesus. Some among them repeated Jesus' teachings to those who would listen. When, however, the world did not end as Jesus and his disciples had believed it soon would, most people found that trying to follow his teachings was impractical. Within 3 score years, scarcely anyone knew his name or what he had preached. Only one disciple remained. This is the disciple who has borne witness to these things and who has written these things and know his testimony is true. As Professor Bart Ehrman put it, and I'll try to put it on the screen, contrary to what you might think, the Christian religion did not begin in the life and teaching of Jesus. Christianity started out as a belief in Jesus' resurrection. If Jesus had been arrested and crucified for crimes against the state, and no one ever came to think that God had raised him from the dead, he would have been at best a footnote in Jewish history, another ill-advised prophet who had made predictions that never came true and paid the price for it with his life. His followers would merely have been a small sect within Judaism that would have died out in time. Instead, here's how a local minister described resurrection. In a commentary in the March 23rd Manchester Journal, Tim Counts, who's the pastor of the Northshire Baptist Church, wrote, Sometimes even Christians forget how crucial the resurrection is to our faith. We need Easter to remind us that resurrection is promise and that it matters. The Apostle Paul explained this in the Bible, quote, "And if Christ has not been raised, then our preaching is in vain and your faith is in vain," 1 Corinthians 15:14. Paul doesn't say that if the resurrection is not true, then at least Christians are bringing some good into the world, so keep doing what you're doing. No, he says, if the resurrection is not true, let's pack it up. Let's close our doors. Reverend Counts ended his commentary this way. Just before he raised Lazarus from the dead, Jesus comforted Lazarus' grief-stricken sister Martha with words that no man has ever been able to repeat. "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live, and everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die." Then he asked her the key question, "Do you believe this?" Christians get excited about Easter because we do believe this, and Easter reminds us that as surely as the snow will melt into spring, resurrection is coming. Thus state Reverend Counts. Now, where did the idea of resurrection come from? Was Jesus the first person who a religion says came back to life in the same body? No. The concept of a dying and rising God was first proposed in comparative mythology by James Frazer's book, The Golden Bough. By the way, here's where Frazer's title came from. Roman legend tells of a tree in a grove sacred to the goddess Diana. No one except a runaway slave was allowed to break off a limb. If a runaway slave broke off one of the boughs, then he could fight to the death the Rex Menorensis, the current king and priest of Diana. If the slave won, he became the next king for as long as he could defeat challenges. Of course, the slaves were mortal, but the kingship was immortal. So in a way, each successive king could be seen as a resurrection of the earlier one. But let's move on from the story of the bow to individuals who were thought to have revived in the same body in which they died. Frazer associated the dying and rising god with the rites surrounding the yearly cycle of vegetation. He cited the examples of Osiris, Tammuz, Adonis, Attis, Dionysus, and Jesus Christ. He thought old religions were fertility cults that revolved around the worship and periodic sacrifice of a sacred king. The king was the incarnation of a dying and reviving god, a solar deity who underwent a mystic marriage to a goddess of the earth. He died at the harvest and was reincarnated in the spring. Frazer claimed that this legend of rebirth was central to almost all the world's mythologies. His book became very popular, but has been increasingly criticized as having cherry-picked evidence from various myths and manipulated to support his thesis. Perhaps you can judge for yourself about Frazer's method from the myth of Dionysus, who was one of Frazer's dying and rising gods. Dionysus was the Greek god of the grape harvest, winemaking, and wine, of ritual madness, fertility, theater, and religious ecstasy. In the Cretan version of the myth, he was the son of Zeus and Persephone, the queen of the Greek underworld. Zeus's jealous wife Hera tried to kill Dionysus when he was a baby by sending divine giants to rip him to pieces. Zeus turned these titans into dust with his thunderbolts, but only after the titans had eaten everything of Dionysus in his heart, which was saved by another god. Zeus used the heart to recreate Dionysus, and he was reborn out of Zeus's thigh. His rebirth is the primary reason for the worship of Dionysus in several mystery religions. The Romans called him Bacchus. Their Bacchic rituals included pulling live animals apart and eating them raw. This served not only as a reenactment of the infant death and rebirth of Bacchus, but also as a means by which Bacchic practitioners produced what they called enthusiasm, which means to let the god enter the practitioner's body or have the practitioner become one with the god, Bacchus. Does this enthusiasm relate to Christians drinking Jesus' blood and eating his body in communion? But we're supposed to be talking about resurrection today, and I have to note that the death and rebirth of Dionysus is a lot different from what we read in the Bible. Frazer's parallel between his death and rebirth and Jesus' does seem rather forced. Still, As you may have noticed in Prelude, there must be something to Fraser's dying, rising god. In Britain, the Corn King, John Barleycorn, is the god who sacrifices himself for the goddess, for the land, for the good harvest to come next year. And he is reborn every year. In a book called Corn King Christianity, the missing option in neo-pagan spectrum, Robert M. Price wrote, "It is striking to find in John's Gospel these words in which Jesus reflects on his own impending death. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit." Paul uses the same metaphor for the general resurrection of the righteous in 1 Corinthians. "What you sow does not come to life unless it dies," etc. Christ also observed, "It is worth noting that the similarity between Jesus' resurrection and those of the Corn Kings is not purely the product of ivory tower scholars compared to ancient texts. John Cuthbert Lawson, in his Modern Greek Folklore and Ancient Greek Religion, recalls how he once chanced to be present at a remote Greek peasant village for their Good Friday and Easter dramas. As the actor playing Jesus was ritually interred, Lawson noticed how an old woman standing beside him seemed greatly agitated. Lawson asked what worried her so. Her response, "If Christ does not rise tomorrow, we shall have no harvest this year." It is safe to say that this old lady had never read The Golden Bough, but then one might say she didn't need to. Christ points out that the Canaanites' myth of their resurrected god Baal, related to the golden calf that Moses found his followers worshiping when he came down from Mount Sinai after getting the Ten Commandments, may have been the foundation for the Christian resurrection story. Christ wrote, "I wonder, in fact, if the mythology of Baal might not be more important for the understanding of the New Testament than the Old. Here is a summary of the Baal myth. The Feast of Rains, the Harvest and New Year Festival, signifies the revival and resurrection of the god Baal, who, having conquered death, sets himself on the throne and is proclaimed king of gods and men. Especially when one recalls that in the Canaanite pantheon, Baal was the son of El, God, just as in the Hebrew Bible. Baal's resurrection victory sounds amazingly like that attributed to Jesus in early Christian preaching. The Christian preaching was that God's son Jesus, by his death and resurrection, had defeated death and had become enthroned as Lord. I cannot help but wonder if the early Christians appropriated the old resurrection theology of Baal to explain what happened to them," Christ concluded. So, Christianity would not exist without belief in Jesus' resurrection. And this belief probably was encouraged by pre-Christian myths of the resurrection of other divine beings. But if that's all there is to today's sermon, I'm reminded of our late Jack Darton's reaction in One Response Time long ago. We had just heard a learned sermon by a visiting minister, but the practical application was, shall we say, less than obvious. Jack spoke up. "That was nice, but so what?" "Well, especially for those of you who don't share my enthusiasm for religious history, I'd better come up with something." So here goes. It's discouraging that someone with religious ideas endorsed by all Christians probably would have been forgotten along with his ideas a couple thousand years ago if he had not been the subject of a miracle, namely resurrection. Actually, the New Testament describes more than one miracle, but resurrection is far and away the most important, and that's why Easter traditionally is the prime Christian holiday. Without miracles, Many people who have preached great ideas or set shining examples have been mostly forgotten. I dare say this especially has happened to those who lived in poverty or belonged to a disrespected race or group. Meanwhile, others have been remembered less on account of their ideas or their example, and more on account of a miracle that they caused, or a miracle that happened to them. I wouldn't go so far as to say that the Roman Catholic Church's requirement of a miracle for sainthood was consciously created for publicity purposes, but the miracle sure does help spread the message. Even worse, the requirement of a miracle to get people's religious attention is not restricted to Christianity. The two other Abrahamic religions share this trait. Would anyone remember Muhammad and the Quran if Muhammad had not said the angel Gabriel told him what to write, and if he had not supposedly taken a miraculous overnight flight on the Sea Burak from Mecca to Jerusalem and then risen to heaven to talk with God? And how many of Judaism's Old Testament prophets would be remembered if God had not supposedly performed miracles really upon them? Why do so many people need miracles before they will pay attention? The need for miracles is addressed this way on the Hindu website. Hindus believe in miracles, and the website says, quote, "Some people think such miracles are secondary to the songs, teachings, or personality of the saint with whom they are associated. A more realistic evaluation is that, as in the case of other world religions, it was the miracles that established the saint's saintliness among the people." Maybe it is, as American poet Wall Stevens wrote in The Necessary Angel, Essays on Reality and Imagination. "Unreal things," he said, "have a reality of their own, and poetry is elsewhere." What does it say about us when we're more attracted by what we hear about somebody or how they appear than by what they have actually done or said? At least if you're a Christian, maybe Jesus' resurrection overshadowing his message was actually good, because without the resurrection, no one would remember the message. In politics, as in religion, sometimes we're lucky when messengers are famous before they begin spreading their message. For example, those of us who support gun control are lucky that the Parkland, Florida students were famous as survivors of a horrific shooting before they began to spread their message of gun control. Would people have paid as much attention if no one in their school had been killed? But this attention to what we hear about somebody or by how they appear can also be dangerous. In religious life, an example would be David Koresh, the leader of the Branch Davidians in Waco, Texas. Did Koresh really have new theological ideas or just a strong personality? In political life, an example is Adolf Hitler. Watch one of his speeches and consider whether the way he delivered them and the spectacles surrounding him was more important to his supporters than what he actually said. And what attracts voters to Donald Trump? Is it his actual program? Maybe not, considering how it changes erratically. Or is it his fame as a virtual reality show host, the way he speaks, and the glitz surrounding him? Do these aspects do the same thing for him as resurrection did for Jesus, but without any of the good results?